Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Lama Tetum and Aleph. Yesterday we left off with the question, Yesh Beger Bekever, in Beger Bekever. Does a girl age in the grave or does not age in the grave? Gemara said, what's the nafkamina between whether she does or does not is to whom the kanas belongs. Does the kanas go to the father or does the kanas go to her son? The problem is, how is it possible that she is a bitula and has a ben? Or how is it possible that she was a ne'ara and passed away while she was a ne'ara and had a child? Gemara says, Umi ma'abro. How is it possible that she already has had a child? V'atani rabibi kamed rav nachman. Shalosh nashim mishamshot b'moch. There are three women who can use moch contraception. Eluhain, tana, umi'uberet, umnika. These three women, a ktana, an underage girl, miuberet, a woman who's already pregnant, a minika, a woman who's nursing. Ktana, an underage woman, shema titaber vitamut. Because maybe she will become pregnant, vitamut, and then she will die. This is according to the girsa that is the outcome, which is shema titaber vitamut, she will become pregnant and then die. There is an alternate girsa in the Gemara in Yevamot, which is Shema Titaber Vishema Tamut, that maybe she will become pregnant and maybe she will die. In that case, it's a more difficult explanation to this sugya. So clearly the Gemara is using the girsa that makes it easier to follow. We shouldn't even deal with the alternate girsa and how it would fit in over here. Meuberet, a woman is already pregnant. Shema Tase Ubra Sandal. Because maybe the existing child will be made into a sandal, be flattened or pancake. Rashi over here suggests that the possibility of her becoming pregnant the second time while she's already pregnant, which of course is very difficult. The Rabbeinu Tam, not here, but in other places already takes issue in Yevamot with that question, says you can't become pregnant if you're already pregnant. And he's saying, what is the Gemara talking about here? And then he suggests over there the possibility that the shichvat zera itself might cause a problem. If there are twins in there already, then a lot of space is taken up, and then the shichvat zera would cause a problem. Now, even though he recognizes the issue with Rashi, his solution is not much more medically sound than Rashi's is. But the Gemara is worried about the shema tasu brasandal. Menika, but the nursing mother, shema tigmolet binah. Problem is that maybe she will have to wean her child because becoming pregnant a second time will dry up her milk supply or limit her milk supply. And then she'll have to wean the child and the child doesn't have formula. So what is he going to do? And it caused the death of this child because his mother can no longer nurse him. Vezihi ketana. Now what ketana are we speaking about here? Because obviously the word ketana simply means a girl who is underage. But in this instance, we're saying that talking about pregnancy and a ktana, how did the two have anything to do with each other? So it's mibat 11 shana v'yom echad, ad 12 shana v'yom echad. From 11 until 12. 12, she becomes of age. She reaches the age of puberty. From that period, a year before, that's where we're worried about. Bachom mikain, under that age, v'yetar alkain, over that age, mishameshet kedarka beholechet. She can have biyah without any problems. Under that age, it's not an issue because she cannot become pregnant. It's just a physical impossibility. She hasn't reached the age where she's menstruating, and therefore she will not become pregnant. So under the age of 11, you don't have to worry about it. Above the age of 12, she's already a gdola. She's already of age, and therefore we don't worry about it. But in that interim stage between 11 and 12, where there is a possibility of her becoming pregnant, but that pregnancy will result in death for her, and obviously death for the baby. Or, again, the other girsa is that there's a high likelihood, or there is a likelihood of death. How is it possible that she would engage in biyah? So therefore, Divrei Rabbi Meir says, Mishamshot b'moch, they use contraception. Now, over here, there are two questions to ask. We already raised one of those issues on Daf Lamed Zayin with Rashi, which is, Rashi says over there, Mishamshot b'moch, notenet moch lachar bi'ila, v'shoevet hazera. Rashi says, Mishameshet b'moch means after the fact, that she puts the moch in to try to draw out the shechvat zera to prevent the pregnancy. On the other hand, the simpler explanation, and Tosafot already raises it over here, it seemingly is a moch that is put in beforehand, that the moch is there prior to that, and it's blocking the ability of the Shechvat Zera to get there, right? So that would prevent her from becoming pregnant. So that's the first question, is what this Mishameshet B'moch is. The Rabbeinu Tam and other places suggest along the lines of Rashi that it's after the fact, because putting in it prior to the fact creates a problem of, it's no different than being Machshit Zera Leitzim Babanim. It's basically allowing the Shechvat Zera to be, or go to waste. But Tosfot says over here, Voda filu haitanu tenet mocha chartashmish asura. Why is it doing it afterwards any less asura than doing it beforehand? Dafa pi she'ena mitzuva al piria rivya. Even though the woman herself is not commanded in piria rivya, which technically should allow her much more room to maneuver, on the other hand, mikoma koma surahi lashchit zera. She's still under that umbrella of not being mashchit zera, based on the Gemara in Nida, that the Gemara seems to indicate that the reason that she's allowed to check and a man should not check has to do with the difference where a man is stimulated by touch, whereas the woman is not stimulated by touch. But the Gemara there seems to suggest that if she was stimulated by touch, that she would also be a surah to do checking. Why should she be a surah to do checking if she is not mitzuvah in piria rivya? Why should there be any problem of quote-unquote hashchatat zera? The answer seemingly is that she is also commanded not lahashchit zera. Tosafot in other places indicates that the hashchatat zera might be from the woman's side herself, that there is some sort of zera emitted by the woman, that it's not just the man, but the woman herself, which is an interesting shita in the Tosafot. Or it could be, more simply, or the easier way to understand is that she's not allowed to be mashchit zera of the man, meaning that in the process of becoming pregnant, she cannot block that from happening, even though technically the mitzvah is on the man and the isur shechvat zera is on the man, nevertheless, she is not allowed to prevent that from happening. That's one question, which is, how is the contraception done here? The second question is, what is meant by Rabbi Meir when he says these three women? Rashi says, mutar. These three women are mutarot to do it, and we don't worry about hashchatat zera. Implications of that, and Tosfot brings them up right away, is Rashi says these women are mutarot, other women are asurot. And that would indicate that contraception is asur, except for these three women. These three women are the exception to the rule. Without that, contraception would clearly be problematic. Tosafot, on the other hand, does not say mutar, but rather says, we suggest, it's atovak mashmalan. It's a suggestion that these women do it, both are not compelled to do it, as well as they are not, quote-unquote, mutarot to do it, just a good idea for them to do that. That has, obviously, less implications about other women, because here we're just saying to these women, you should do it, because of the benefits of doing it. Doesn't mean that other women are asurot, and doesn't mean that these women are compelled or should do it. It's just that we tell them it's probably a good idea. Now that obviously has broader implications for contraception in general, whether women are allowed to use contraception. According to Rashi, it's pretty clear if they don't fall into the category of these three women that it would be problematic. According to Tosafot, you could come up with other scenarios possibly where contraception would be allowed because of the fact that it has a factor like here, where it would be a good idea to use it, even though, quote unquote, in general, we would not allow it or we would not suggest it. There may be times and places where it is worthy to be suggested or where it should be utilized. In terms of using contraception today, many of the poskim focus on these issues. Of course, the method of contraception obviously is important, if it can be used at all. The method is important, and that many times the use of the pill by the woman is a better way to deal with it, because then the function is normal. It's just that the pill prevents there from being a pregnancy. That has to do with a little bit of what Tosafot says over here, which is that we never say that a person cannot have Tashmisha Mita with a Ktana or an Ilonit, even though we know that a Ktana and Ilonit will not become pregnant. So we don't say over there that's Hashchatat Zera, that's just wasting Zera, because it's done in the normal way. It's done in the normal way that people engage in intimate relations, and therefore it's not called Hashchatat Zera. That also opens up a window in that way, which says that as long as you're acting in the normal way, if there's somehow a prevention of the pregnancy, then maybe that is okay, or maybe that's less problematic. Just like by ketana and ilonit, or physically incapable, also as kena after the age of menopause. Nobody says that's called hashchatat zera, because acting in a normal way that a man and woman would act, it happens to be that these women will not become pregnant. So again, if you can simulate that effect, maybe that would be an easier way or a better way to deal with contraception. That's number one. Number two is the permissibility of contraception. Again, most of the poskim are very against it. And until a couple has at least accomplished piriya or rivya, number one. And number two, even after piriya rivya, where there is still a residual, an additional mitzvah of yeshevet yitzara, there's also the additional mitzvah of, even if one has had children when they're young, there's still another mitzvah to have children when they get older. And that there are continuous mitzvot or reasons to engage and to continue to have children. And therefore, most of the poskim are very against using contraception, except in extreme cases or cases of necessity. And that's really where a lot of the machloket about it today comes about, is what is considered to be necessity. But it's pretty clear from the poskim that convenience is not one of those areas of permissibility, finishing up school or other factors like that. I've heard from Rabbi Neuberger that he has a mesora that affordability should never be a consideration in having children, and that the Kadosh Baruch Hu provides. If one has the children, then the Kadosh Baruch Hu provides. Again, these are questions that are very, very fundamental and difficult questions that have to be asked of a Rav. And there are numerous opinions about this, but I think that if it's really looked into carefully, there's a very narrow scope of times that we do allow it, or we do permit these types of issues. Now again, today, there might be a factor that was less recognized earlier, which are psychological factors. Because obviously for physical issues, we do allow the use possibly of contraception, like here in the Gemara. Question is, if a psychological factors where a woman would be incapable of maintaining her sanity in that situation, or would bring her to a point where it would be very difficult for her, or even for the father, with the number of kids or the nature of the kids, that maybe there should be some sort of permissibility today, where the recognition of the psychological impact of these types of things is as important as the physical impact. So maybe that's one area where might have been some change in the understanding or permissibility of allowing the use of contraception. All right, so now, Chachamim amim, achat zu v'achat zu mishameshet kidarka v'olechet. Chachamim say, we don't worry about these issues, u'min ha-shamayim yirachamu. And in the heavens, they will have mercy, mishum shneamar, shomer pitaim Hashem. Hashem guards over those that are foolish. We've discussed this numerous times. There is also a mitzvah of v'chai behem, there's a mitzvah to protect oneself. We don't automatically say, take dangers, and Hashem protects the fools. Shomer b'tayim Hashem is only invoked where it's a common practice. It's a normal way for people to engage in these activities. And since it's the normal way for people to engage, then we say Shomer b'tayim Hashem. Both because the higher percentage is that something will not happen. It's a low percentage that there is a problem, or a low enough percentage that there is a problem. Plus, we see that people are surviving and it's okay. Number two is that it's a reasonable risk to be undertaken. So in those cases, we say Shomer Pateim Hashem. But again, if it's something that is not undertaken by the population at large, it's not a normal practice, or there are overwhelming evidence of a problem in these situations, or that the danger is so great that we say that normal people would not make that decision to enter into that situation, then we no longer say Shomer B'tayim Hashem. We say that your person has to protect themselves and has an obligation to ensure that they're in a safe environment. I always give the example that to get into a car and drive, even though unfortunately there are car accidents and there are problems with getting into a car, nevertheless, there we do say Shomer B'tayim Hashem. But getting into a car and not wearing a seatbelt, we do not say Shomer B'tayim Hashem there. Again, because it's a risk that has overwhelming odds against it, which are that in situations of accidents or problems, the seatbelt is proven to make a big difference and to change the outcome of the situation. it's a risk that is not worth undertaking and endangers one's life. So here there's a clear difference between not putting on a seatbelt or getting in a car. Riding a bicycle and not wearing a helmet. It's the same thing there. Riding a bicycle is a risk undertaken by people. It's a normal risk. People do fine with it. Not putting on a helmet, again, there's overwhelming evidence that not wearing a helmet endangers one life in situations where they would need the helmet. And therefore, again, not wearing the helmet may not be covered by Shomer P'tayim Hashem, even though, unfortunately, it looks like many people think that that is the practice at large, not to wear a helmet. But it's very clear that the evidence is to the contrary. Okay, V'chi Teima. So now the problem, and here's the question. The problem is that we have a Ne'ara here, because as being a Ne'ara, she was entitled to Knas. There is very limited time in which she could have a child, and also have the situation in which the Knas is relevant. Rashi asks your question. Rashi says, V'chi Teima Yibad 12 Yom Echad Shigyu Yomei Anirim Nitabra V'yalda B'Narut U'meita B'Narut. Say she became pregnant while she was in Nara. Endowed while she was in Nara. Hanami leita. That can't be. Damar Shmuel ain't bein Narut u'bagrut el shisha chodoshim. There's only 6 months of Narut. So she can't possibly have become pregnant while she was in Nara. And also given birth while she was in Nara. Because it's only a 6 month window. Ela shisha chodoshim ishidavish desharot avi Nara. So only for 6 months after puberty is she in Nara. Obviously, it's talking about a case where she reached puberty before she became pregnant. As long as she hasn't reached the age of puberty, she's considered to be a ktana. Doesn't matter if she crosses over 12. Okay. None of that matters because she hasn't reached puberty. So then, why does it mention the years at all? It's all subject to puberty, then why do the years matter? Because under 12, afilu hevi'ash se'arot, einu ela shuma. The Gemara discusses in other places that under that age, we suspect that puberty has not been reached, and that what we're looking at here is not really hair, but rather some sort of birthmark or some sort of growth that is not related to puberty. So therefore now you're stuck in a very, very small window, where this girl could be a Ne'ara and die while she is a Ne'ara. We want her to pass away while she's a Ne'ara, but also to have a baby prior to that point in time. So if she became pregnant after she reached the age of puberty, then she only has from 12 to 12 and a half to become pregnant, have the baby, and die while she's a Ne'ara. There's just not sufficient time in here for that to happen. So that's what the Gemara is going to ask, but I'm just laying it out here. V'chi teima di'abra kashi Ne'ara. Let us say that she became pregnant while she was in Nara, ve'olida kashi Nara, and then she gave birth while she was in Nara, u'b'shiti yarche mikayalda. How does a woman give birth within 6 months? That is really pressing the limit of getting there, where she could have a baby within 6 months. V'amar Shmuel, ein ba'in Narut u'bagrut el'shisha chodoshim. So that's what Rashi noted for us, that the duration of Narut is only 6 months. V'chiteima batzuhu deleka hatfeika. Maybe that's the minimum. 6 months is the minimum shear of bagrut, but you could have more than that. Ha Ella Kamar says Ella. Ella is an exclusionary term. Ella means that that's it. It's 6 months and it is no more, no less. So we have to change the nature of the question over here because we have an impossibility. We have this girl who is a bitula, and the situation in which this has to transpire is that she was a bitula when she was raped. Then she has a child. And then she passes away while she still is a ne'ara. And that's what raises the question here. Is there beggar bekever or ain't beggar bekever? And we don't have sufficient time for that to transpire over here. Because, again, if she was a ne'ara, by the time she is a ne'ara, then for her to become pregnant and die while she's a ne'ara is only a window of 6 months. And that makes it impossible for her to have a child. And therefore the whole nafkamina or query that we were discussing according to Rova seems meaningless. Jej beggar bekever, ain't beggar bekever with regards to her son. That isn't relevant because there never will be a son in this case. If you're ever being raped when she's a bitula ne'ara. And that's why it would have been in father's entitlement to the knas. And then we have a situation in which she becomes pregnant and then has the child and dies when she's in Ara. That combination just is impossible over that small duration of 6 months. maybe you hold like the Chachamim that she was a Ktana and she collects Knas. But we know already that in terms of a Ktana, she has a limited perspective in which she will have a child because she can only become pregnant when she is of age.
Because Rabbi Meir believes that a Ktana cannot become pregnant. And even if you hold like the Chachamim, as the Rashba points out, when they say, Min Hashemayim Yirachamu is that she shouldn't become pregnant. They might agree with Rabbi Meir that if she becomes pregnant, she will die. Min Hashemayim Yirachamu is that she won't become pregnant during that period of time so that she won't die. So neither of them believe that she can have a baby and survive if she became pregnant while she was a Ktana. So even if you hold like the Chachamim Shita that a Ktana can collect Knas, nevertheless, you still can't have a manifestation where she will be pregnant while she is a Ktana. She can only become pregnant when she is a Nara. And that eliminates the possibility of her dying while she's a Nara and already having a child.
So now the Gemara says, we'll have to reword the question, but Elohaki Kami Baile, this is the question. Yesh Beger Bekever Upaka Av. Is there maturing in the grave, and therefore the Av, the father's out of the picture? Odilma ain't beggar bekever velo pakav. Or maybe there is no aging in the grave and the father is still entitled to the payment over here. Because her life ended while she was in Nara, does that make it static now that she remains in Nara and the father is entitled to payments that go to a Nara and that will continue to be the case? Or do we say that there is quote unquote aging in the kever? And since there's aging in the kever, the father will effectively lose his rights to the payment because she's no longer a Nara, she's now a Bogeret. And for a Bogeret, the Knas belongs to her. Marba Rashi Baila Hochi. Marba Rashi says the questions like this. Mitase Bagrut, Oenase Bagrut. Teku. The question is not whether there's aging in the kever, but simply does death trigger Bagrut? Now, here, obviously, she's not a Bogeret. Just because she dies, the question is, does death terminate the relationship that is here? You could look at this in two ways. It could be positive and negative, which is, do we say that death triggers her being bogeret, which means she's entitled to the collection, her father is not entitled to the collection? That would be the way to say it in a full sense. Or the question could really be, is she mita, does death already terminate the relationship with the father, but the father is no longer allowed to collect on her behalf? It doesn't mean that she is a bogeret and she could collect on her own behalf. Just simply that the father no longer has the right to collect. There will be a nafkamina between those, which is if she has creditors. If she has creditors, and we say that when we ask the question over here, does death cause her to be a bogeret and she's entitled to the payment now, then it would make a difference because her creditors could then claim on her behalf and get the money because of Rabbi Natan, which is the transient property of debt. And therefore, they could come and collect the knas to repay their debts. Father's clearly out of the picture. Or do we simply say it in the negative sense, which is that the father loses his right to collect, but that doesn't empower anybody else to collect on her behalf. She's not a bogeret. It's just simply that mita terminates the relationship that she had with her father, and her father can no longer collect, but that doesn't empower anybody else to collect on her behalf. So most of the Rishonim frame the question simply as a negative statement, which is the relationship with the father severed at death? Or not severed at death, and he leaves it as a teku, as an unresolved issue. Now, Marba Rav Ashi, Baye says, Baal El Meita Patur. Then, the Gemara says, Rava doesn't think that. Rava thinks it's a question. Rashi says that that question is only according to Marba Rav Ashi. Marba Rav Ashi over here says that the question is, does Mita Ose Bagrut or Nain Ose Bagrut? That's the question that Rava is asking that Rabbi thinks is simple. In the first Lashon of Rava, where we say, Yesh Beger Bakever, Ain Beger Bakever, the Lishna Kama Mishab Shita the Rava, the Mita Lomafka. It's very clear according to that Lashon that Rava believes that death does not terminate the need to pay the Knas. Simply a question about who the Knas goes to. So over there, he definitely argues on Abaye, and there's no question. So when the Gemara before said something that is simple for Abaye is a question for Rava, that was a Liba de Ravashi. The way that Ravashi formulates the question is whether Mita Osebeger or Ain Mita Osebeger. And that's where the Gemara here we started and got us down this path is that this is Rava's question. And that's where he doesn't necessarily agree with Abaye because he questions Abaye's presumption. Again, in the first lesson of Rava, he clearly disagrees with Abaye. Abaye says, Ein Knas after Mita. And Rava clearly says, Yesh Knas after Mita. I just don't know who to pay it to. What happens if he rapes her and then she gets engaged? Gets engaged to someone else after this incident. Now, Tosafot points out over here, this question is really only related to one of the opinions that we saw before. We saw three opinions before. Rabbi Kiva the Mishnah, Rabbi Kiva of the Braita, and Rabbi Yossi HaGalili. According to Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, where nit arsa ve nit garsha, in a case where she was already engaged and got divorced, she loses out on her knas if she was raped after that fact. There is no knas because that's a gzerat hakatuv. According to Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, that is the gzerat hakatuv. Erusin have no impact except the fact that it says asher lo arasa, the gzerat hakatuv is if she was already engaged, she doesn't get knas. But that's not to say that she's still not a nera, and that's still under the auspices of her father. According to that, there's no question here. She clearly is still considered to be a nera, and her father would collect in this case. On the other hand, according to Rabbi Kiva of the Braita, who says that knas belongs to her father, then over here as well, the knas certainly will belong to her father, because according to him, nitarsa v'nitarsha, still the father retains the rights. So over here, if nitarsa, her father still retains the rights. The only question is, according to Rabbi Kiva of the Mishnah, and Rabbi Kiva of the Mishnah says that when nitarsa v'nitarsha, she has the rights to the knas, then this is the question over here. If she becomes engaged after the fact, does that now grant her the right to collect the knas or receive the knas, versus her father still collecting the knas? Amalei miktiv v'natan la'avi ha'ne'ara asher lo arusa. The pasuk doesn't say that you give it to the father of ne'ara who is not engaged. That's not what it says over there. It says that it's not given to the ne'ara who was engaged. That was asher lo arusa. And whatever you darshan for that, whether it's the gzeirah shava or whether it is the fact that if she was already engaged, then there is no knas. But it certainly doesn't say that the Avi HaNa'ara loses his rights to collect over here if she is engaged. Uletameich, according to your reasoning, Adatanya, what are you going to do with this braita? Balev and Isek Latzma. In a case where he raped her and then she gets fully married, the knas goes to her. There it's clear. Miktiv natan la Avi HaNa'ara asher lo nisua. Well, how are you going to explain that in the pasuk? It says give it to the father of the Na'ara. It doesn't say the father of the Na'ara who's not married. Could be that she's married and he still should be able to collect it. And I says, okay, Ashta, how do you compare these cases? We know that reaching the age of bagrut, the maturity, takes her out of the possession of the father, meaning that if the knas is paid when she's a bulgarit, it clearly goes to her. And marriage takes her out of the auspices of the father. Just like by the case of bagrut, again, where she's on her own when she reaches the age of maturity. Plus, we know for sure if knas is paid when she is a bulgarit, it goes to her. So too, marriage has the same impact. Just like marriage takes her out of the possession of the father, so too, it should take him out of the ability of collecting knas anymore, and the knas should go to the woman herself. And therefore, if he has a rape case and she gets married, it'll belong to her. Elo Erusin is the question, because Erusin is this transitional phase between leaving the father's house and entering to the husband's house. It's an interim stage where she is quasi-married and where she's still quasi-at home. And we've seen this in Yevamot. There are different halachot that apply to the Arusa, some of which leave her in her father's house, some of which bring her to the house of the Baal. So, mikam if mafke mershuta de av legamrei. Does that remove her from the hands of the father entirely? Now, it's clear that the Torah is mezakeh the av by cases of mamon. Because mitziata and maaseh yadeha in these instances belong to the father during the period of narut. And seemingly in the period of erusin, they belong to the father. Now, the question here is, if that's the case, then this is a monetary obligation. And the monetary obligation should therefore belong to the father. What's the question here at all? The answer might be is that we're dealing with a knas over here. And a knas that derives from an isur. And therefore maybe that din is different. And therefore we look for a solution that might cover that. So Gemara says, Hatznan, we have a Mishnah. Nara murasa, avia uvala mefirin la nidara. But we have a Mishnah by Haparat Nidarim, which I mentioned yesterday, that in time of Erusin, both the father and the husband have joint rights of nullification, which shows you that she's partially belongs to the Baal, or partially under the auspices of the Baal, partly under the auspices of the father. And so because of that, we see that there is a tension here between whether the father really has entitlement,
or doesn't have entitlement over here, and that's why there is a question as to what is the status when it comes to a woman who is in Arusa. Okay, now we move on to the next Mishnah. Hamifateh noten shlosha dvarim, ve'ones arba'a. Seduction. Mifateh has to pay for three things. A rape has to pay four things. Mifateh noten boshet upigam uknas. He pays for boshet, the embarrassment, pigam, the diminution in value, and the knas is the 50 shekel kesef that the Torah lays out. Mosif alav ones, shnoten et tzar. He also has to pay for the tzar, the pain that was involved. Ma bein ones lemifateh. What's the difference between ones and mifateh? Ones noten et tzar. Again, that seems repetitive, that's redundant, it explains what we saw before. But, ones noten miyad, ones pays right away. That's irrespective of whether he marries or doesn't marry her, he's got to pay the money right away, he pays the knas immediately. And the mifateh, only once he divorces her, that is not exactly what it means over here. It really means that if he chooses not to marry her, then he's got to pay the knas. If he marries her, then he doesn't pay the knas. Ones shote ba'atzitzo. The ones drinks from his cup. Basically, the bed that he made, he's got to lay in. He raped this woman. He's got to marry her. There's no questions asked over here. There's no option for him to back out. V'mifateh imratza lotzi motzi. Mifateh is optional. If he chooses to marry her, that's fine. Chooses not to marry her, then he's got to pay the knas. I mean, it's a decision point for him. Ketzad shote ba'atzitzo. What does that mean? That he's got a drink from his cup? Again, atzitz is a plant pot. That's usually where it's used in the Gemara. Atzitz she'inu nakuv, atzitz nakuv. That is a plant pot, which is not usually used for drinking. So when we say shote ba'atzitzo, he took a woman that wasn't right for him or wasn't necessarily willing to join him. Now that he's already acted on it and decided that he's willing to drink from this cup that doesn't necessarily fit appropriately or is not even potable, the water that's in it. Nevertheless, once he did that, he's got to continue drinking from it. He made a choice. So I feel he chigeret, even if she's lame, I feel he suma, even if she's blind, I feel he mukat shchin, even if she is sickly in any way, then he's got to take her. I mean, he doesn't have any choice to say, I'm not interested, this woman is not appealing to me. She was appealing enough that he acted this way, then he's got to keep her forever. Nimsa ba davar erva. If there's a problem of erva, or she is not allowed to join Klal Yisrael, then he can't keep her as a wife because that would be violating an isur for him to keep her as a wife. Shenemar, that she will be for him a wife. It has to be a woman that is appropriate for him. Now, just as a little background to this, obviously it seems strange in terms of the punishment of the Torah, that this girl, after being raped, now has to live with this man for the rest of her life. But it's also important to understand the cultural framework in which this happens. What the Torah did here is a tremendous innovation in protecting the woman and taking care of the woman. In their day, a woman who was raped basically became damaged goods and almost nobody would marry her. And she would basically left penniless to die because nobody would take care of her. There was a shame of the family. People would not marry her. This woman was in a desperate situation. You see that in the case in Tanakh by Amnon and Tamar. After Amnon rapes his sister Tamar, she begs him not to throw her out of the house. She just says, keep me here. Just let me stay. Let us just continue in this way, because she knows once she walks out of there, that's the end for her. And that's what happens. She goes, lives by her brother for the rest of her life. Her brother Avshalom actually names one of his children after his sister. But she basically goes to live with her brother and she has no future. Her brother happens to have taken care of her, so she was lucky. But that's not necessarily the case. What this does, or the innovation of the Torah, is it forces this person who caused her this difficulty, this problem, basically to take care of her for the rest of his life. That's one thing to consider here. And again, that's a huge innovation of the Torah, to protect this woman, rather than to leave her basically be left to ruin if he didn't take care of her. So that's one thing. That's a positive. The second thing is, the Torah isn't necessarily written for Rishaim. The Torah is written for the average man. So this idea that when an individual rapes a woman, he'll have to keep her for the rest of his life, the idea is not necessarily the punishment itself, but the idea of deterrence, which is the appeal of rape is that there is a momentary drive, there's a spontaneity in this individual where he feels that he's going to gain something from this, and he can do this act and then walk away from it and everything will be fine. What the Torah says is, remember, there are going to be long-term implications to what you do here. That the Torah is trying to do is make the person beforehand think about what they're doing. When they have this sudden drive or urge to do something like this, even though it's improper and getting the better of them, what the Torah wants them to do is consider that this will have long-term implications. You think it's a one-night thing. You think it's a momentary giving in to your drives. That's not the case. This woman will be with you for the rest of your life. And what the Torah is trying to do is beforehand create a deterrence for this type of behavior and say that if you're going to act like this, it's not going to be something that is just for the moment. It's not something you're going to be able to walk away from. It's going to be something that's going to leave you permanently attached to this woman. So you better rethink how you approach this. And what the Torah is trying to do is help people before the fact, or help give people the tools by which to reconsider and prevent them from acting in this way, which is, know that this is not a one-time act. This is something that's going to be with you for the rest of your life. And therefore, I think that gives some sort of framework or understanding to this punishment of the fact that the woman has to marry the man afterwards. It has two impacts. Again, the protection of the woman, but also the impact of making the person think about it before he acts in this way. Tzar demai. Gemara asks, what type of pain are we talking about over here? Tosafot already jumps up right away. What do you mean what type of pain here? It's very clear that a woman who is a bitula and is subject to biyah is in pain. What is the question of the Gemara over here? The tzar demai. Of course there is tzar. Tzar tashmish, tzar bi'ila'a. There's clearly tzar over here. Why does the Gemara even ask what the tzar is? The answer might be, the Gemara might be asking from one of two perspectives. One is that the Gemara in a second will say, why do you differentiate between mifuta and anusa? If this pain exists, then there really should be no differentiation between anusa and a mifuta. That's one thing. Number two is, Tosafot points out over here that the tavata tashmish, the desire for tashmish, overrides the, what are called the initial pain or the pain incurred, and it's really a residual pain that is caused. And since it's a residual pain after the fact, it actually really becomes a tzar of grama and not a tzar of the act. It's not something that's directly involved with the act itself, but an after effect or the result of the act afterwards, there is residual pain. And therefore, that tzar, why is that even considered over here? Because that is tzar that is not a direct nezek. For those two reasons, the Tosafot suggests that the Gemara over here is asking, why don't either we equate the tzar from Mifuta and Anusa, or what is the tzar exactly that we're talking about here that's not grama? So Amar Avua Deshmol, tzar shechavtal gabe karka. So he says, because in the case of Me'anes, he throws her to the ground, he does it in a way where there is other pain involved, not just the pain of biyah, but the violence associated with it. So, according to your reasoning, if he was gentle with her, or he put her down on a mattress, somehow that there wasn't violence that caused her any other injury, then she'd be patur from the tzar. We don't find that. If you want to say, oh yeah, you're right. The ones should not pay tzar, mipnesha sofa, lehitz the air, tachat bala. There's no reason to pray for tzar, because this was an inevitable outcome. She was eventually going to become a bi'ula. Whether she becomes a bi'ula here through ones, or she becomes a bi'ula through marrying her husband, this pain is not something that she could have avoided. Then why should he have to pay for the tzar of something that's inevitably going to happen to her? But what you see clearly is that there's a connection here between what her husband's going to do to her and, quote-unquote, what the rapist did to her. If that's the case, what, her husband's going to throw her on the floor? That's what we're worried about? Oh, just because the manes threw her on the floor, and that's the tzar we're talking about here. So too, we would say, oh, it's inevitable that her husband will throw her on the floor? That's definitely not the equation that is being drawn over here. And so clearly, the tzar that we're talking about here is something that will happen with her husband and something that the manes is causing or accelerating in this case. So Amr Lo, Eino Domen Nivelet Bilnes, Nivelet Biratzon. There's a big difference between someone who's forced in Biyah to someone who willingly participates in Biyah. If that's the case, we can understand why there would be tzar here that you would have to pay for versus tzar by her husband. I mean that Rabbi Shimon says it's an inevitable outcome that she's going to have this pain. So the Chachamim say back to them, well, there's a big difference. There's the pain when it's done willingly? Is it pain when it's done by violence or by force? And there is a difference in that pain. We're still not sure what that pain is, but there's clearly a difference between marriage and rape. So it has to do with not, again, the losing of the bitulim. The losing of the bitulim, which again are an inevitable outcome, and something that she's going to experience either way. Now, we did suggest maybe there's a difference between willing and unwilling, but similarly there's no difference because that's just a physical reality. Where does that difference between willing and unwilling come out? That has to do with the pisuk raglayim, the spreading of her legs, the spreading of her legs, whether it's done willingly, and she's a willing participant versus being forced to do that, where it can be very painful and difficult. B'chein omer, v'tifashki et raglayich l'cholover. Here, it's saying this in a detrimental and negative way about Klal Yisrael, that you spread your legs to every passerby. Here it's talking about how they're not interested in Hashem, and they're just open to everything else. And the Rishonim explain over here that even though there was pain involved in the Pisuk Raglayim, that's not clear from the Pasuk that there's pain involved, but that may be the whole criticism, which is that this is, even though there was pain involved, you were willing to open your legs to everybody else, to give up Hashem and take that pain. So that's what the Gemara is bringing that Pasuk as a proof for, the fact that the Pisuk Raglayim. Gemara says, Yehochi Mifuta Nami. So what about Mifuta? Why isn't she entitled to Tzar? What is the case of Mifuta, the case of seduction? Rip my clothing and you'll be patur. So to over here, even though the woman doesn't explicitly say that she is forgiving it, but implicit in her actions and in acquiescing to the seduction is that she's basically giving up on that right or giving up on the claim. Gemara says, Shali, over there by the case of clothing where he says, rip my clothing and you're patur, that's fine because he owns the clothing. Over here, how can she forgive the payment when the payment goes to her father? Davua ninu. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Avua, Pichot Sheben Omrot, Mifuta in Latzar. Women suggest, and here are the smarter, the wise women tell us, that there isn't Tzar by the Mifuta. So here again, the Gemara is differentiating along these lines, which are the question of Iachi Nami Mifuta, there should be a Tzar of Pisuk Raglayim. The Gemara says that there's a difference between Mifuta, Meanes, and getting married. So let's go through this. In terms of all three of them, there is Tzar Bitulim, and that will exist whether she's a Mifuta, whether she is Nenas, or whether she got married. All of those apply, and therefore that Tzar is not relevant over here because it's an inevitable Tzar, and therefore he shouldn't have to pay for that Tzar, which he would have experienced. Now you could argue, she could say, I was never going to get married. If I'm not going to get married, I wouldn't have had this pain, and now you have to compensate me because I would have avoided that pain. So the Chazam Sofer over here says that if she says she's never going to get married, she's not entitled to the payment. Because the payment is in lieu of what would have been paid in a normal situation of marriage. The whole idea of the knas, and we learn from the knas about the size of ketubah, is the money that the woman is entitled to from getting married. So what happens is he basically gets it, the money is paid up front. We're going to see that later on in today's daf. Which is basically, it's an acceleration of that payment up front. So if she's not going to say, I'm not going to get married, then she's not really entitled to the payment. So it's almost mutually exclusive. She's not going to get married, she's not entitled to the payment. If she's going to get married, she would have experienced the tzar anyway. The Gemara says, okay, it can't be the violence that is associated with the rape. Clearly, he's on the hook for that. I mean, that any damage, any pain that is caused because of those factors, he will have to pay for, and he will have to pay restitution and take care of this woman, medical bills, anything else, he will definitely have to deal with. But that's clearly not the tzar that we're speaking about here because of the fact that Rabbi Shimon compares the tzar here to the tzar of a husband and says it's an inevitable outcome. Well, the tzar of the violence that surrounds the rape, that clearly is not what the husband's going to do. So how can you compare the two? So it has to be something directly connected to the act of bi'ah itself, that the husband will also do. And the answer is Pisuk Raglayim. Some suggest that the El Amar of Nachman over here signals that the Gemara is rejecting the previous answer and now going back to the original that we're talking about to Tzar Biyah. So whether it is Pisuk Raglayim or Tzar Biyah, the following distinctions would apply. That the Pisuk Raglayim there where, again, a woman who is willingly participating, even though there might be some pain or it might be some discomfort. Over there, since she is a willing participant, there is no real tsar. But again, when she's forced, or where she's trying to prevent it, and she's being overpowered, over there is pain, and over there is difficulty because of that, and that fighting, and that is what the tsar that we're discussing over here. And again, the reason for that by seduction doesn't apply is because the woman isn't fighting against it, and therefore, even by mifuta, even though she's seduced, and there is pisuk raglaim, that is more along or akin to the pisuk raglaim of marriage than that of me'anes. The Gemara says, Va'aka chazina di'itla. So the Gemara says, a very interesting question. We have empirical evidence that there is pain here. That you can't say that the pisuk raglaim does not come with pain involved with it, and that's whether she's forced or not forced. There is this problem of pisuk raglaim. If that's the case, then either, why don't we force a mifuta to pay for that pain? Or why don't we say that a me'anes is exempt because there still is pain when a woman's married and she is a willing participant? So my Abaye, Amrli Aim, Abaye says, my mother told me, and as Rashi points out over here, Abaye did not have a mother because his father passed away at conception, his mother passed away at birth, he was an orphan brought up by Rabba, but we find many instances where Abaye says in Shas, Amrli Aim, we saw in the Gemara all the medicinal things that his mother told him about that are brought down in the Gemara and Shabbat. What Rashi says over here is that it was his nurse or his adoptive mother that he's speaking about over here, not necessarily his biological mother. Kamaya chamime areshe dekarcha. It's like hot water or warm water on the head of a bald individual. Rava Amar, Amarli Bat Rav Chista. Rava says, the daughter of Rav Chista, who was his wife, told me, Kirivda de Kusilta. It is like the prick of the blood letter. Rapapa Amar Amarli Bat Abba Surah. Rapapa says, the daughter of Abba Surah, who is his wife, told me, Kenema Akusha Bechinche. It is like hard bread on the palate. So a hard or crusty bread that you eat that scratches the palate a little bit, that's what it's like. So what these women, who are their wives, are telling them is that there is pain, but the pain is minimal. Not something that you would consider to be tsar, that cannot be handled or overcome. And therefore, there is a difference between the tsar of pisuk raglaim that we see does exist in marriage, the natural tsar that exists, which is a manageable tsar, versus the tsar that has to do with me'anes, which is an extreme form of tsar, and therefore there is a difference. Again, mifateh sits in the middle, but mifateh, because she was willing, because it looks more like marriage, and therefore there's no tsar. So the Gemara says, acknowledges there is tsar involved, even in marriage, even in the normal course, but the tsar of the me'anes is significantly above the tsar of normal marriage, and that's why he's going to have to pay for the tsar, because there is that differential. Ones notain miyad, v'amifateh shiotzi. The ones has to give right away, and the mifateh only when he divorces her. Likishiotzi. What do you mean when he divorces her? Ishtohi. She's his wife? Well, since when did she become his wife? He didn't marry her. Where did he marry her? All he did was seduced her. Where is there a marriage that we're talking about divorce here? So Rabbi Ema Kishalo Yichnos. It really means that if he chooses not to marry her, the equivalent of quote-unquote divorcing her, then he pays the knas. Tanya Nami Ochi, a braita that supports that understanding. Afa Pishi Amru Amifateh Notein. Even though we say that Mifateh has to pay the penalty, Kishalo Yichnos, when he doesn't marry her, Boshed and Begam notay miyad. Boshed and Begam are paid immediately, because those have no relationship to the marriage itself. So as far as the kenas is concerned, the kenas is determined by whether he marries the woman or doesn't. If he marries the woman, there's no kenas. If he doesn't marry the woman, he's got to pay the kenas. Irrespective of that, the Boshed and Begam, he's got to pay right away. Ve'achad ha'ones, ve'achad ha'mifateh, ben hi, ben avia, yocholim la'akev. So here is the question that you've all been asking, which is, whether it's a case of rape, whether it's a case of seduction, whether it's her, whether it's her father, yucholim la'akev, they can reject the marriage over here. They can opt out. It's not the choice of the rapist. It's not the choice of the seducer. The woman has a right of refusal, and the father of the woman has a right of refusal over here. So the Gemara says, bishlam amifutaktiv. By mifuta, it says, ima'ein yima'ein aviha. If the father refuses to give his daughter to this man as a wife, so there we see that the father can reject it, because it says, if he chooses not to give her to him as a wife, that we see her father has a right of refusal.
Hiatz maminayin. How do we know that she herself has the right of refusal? Tamalomar yima'ain. It's ma'ain yima'ain komakom. The extra lashon tells us that she also has a right of refusal. Mikomakom. If there's a refusal from any party here, we do not force the marriage to go through. Therefore, there's a right of refusal by all parties. By the case of mifateh, father can reject it, the daughter can reject it, and the mifateh, the seducer, can say, I don't want to get married. Now, the implications of him not getting married is he's going to have to pay the kenas. Ella ones, in the case of rape, bishlama ihi, when it comes to her, we understand that she can reject his marrying her. Div velotiyah, lotiyah liisha, tiyah is midata, that she has to be a willing participant over here. Rashi says the word tiyah over here, mashmahi mehavet atzmolo. She presents himself to her. So that's what the word tiyah means, that she willingly presents herself to him, therefore the marriage goes through. Meaning, if she refuses, the marriage will not go through. It's an interesting formulation because it comes up in the Gemara and Nidarim as to what is a woman's role in Kiddushin. What does the woman do in terms of Kiddushin? And it goes across the board with regards to the Rishonim. How they view the woman's participation in Kiddushin. The Ran has the most extreme view there in Nidarim. The Ran says the woman simply does not refuse or allows, facilitates the Kiddushin to go through. She's not really an active participant. She just does not reject it going through. Something similar is being said here in Rashi, which is that velotia midata means masha mihavet atzmalo. She presents herself to him. She does not reject it. So maybe similar type of formulation to the Ran in Nidarim. Ella aviyaminolan, how do we know that her father has a right of refusal over here? Amar Abaye, Abaye says very simply, shlo yechote niskar. Why should the sinner benefit? Why should the rapist over here be the choice and the father not have a choice over here? Rav Amar kal v'chomer, it's a logical thing. Uma mifateh shlo avar ela adat aviya bilvad. In the case of mifateh, she succumbed to the seduction. So she agreed. Her father obviously did not agree because he wasn't asked in this case. So Benhi uben aviya yecholim lakev. Nevertheless, the Torah empowers both her and her father to reject. Ones shavar al dat aviya v'dat atzma. The case of rape, where he didn't ask for her permission, and he didn't ask the father's permission, lo kol shekein, certainly over there, both parties should have the right to reject it. So in a case where the woman herself agreed, we still give the father rejection rights. In a case where she didn't agree, certainly the father should have rejection rights. Rava lo amar ki Abaye, Rava does not agree with Abaye's reasoning over here, came in to come shalem knas, lav chote niskaru. It's not called chote niskar because he's paying the knas. So he's not going to benefit in either way. The fact that he marries her or he doesn't marry her is not chote niskar. The niskar is the payment of the knas. And whether he marries her or not, he's going to have to pay the knas in the case of mianes. So there's no chote niskar over here. Obviously, that's a very narrow definition of chote niskar. Chote niskar over here, Rava is simply looking at the monetary issue, which is, does he pay the knas or not pay the knas? Abaye sees obviously a much broader view or perspective here, which is the fact that she marries him, it also could be a case of chote niskar. If he really wants to marry this woman, he can force the situation then. And so Abaye says, chote niskar should give the right of the father to refuse and the right of the daughter to refuse. Abaye lo amar ki Rava, mifateh deihu matzi me'akev. In the case of the seduction, where the perpetrator of the crime has a right of walking away, Aviya nami matzi me'akev. The father also has the right to reject it. Ones, diyu lo matzi me'akev. In the case of Ones, where the rapist doesn't have a right of rejection, because he has to marry her, Aviya nami lo matzi me'akev. The father also doesn't have a right of rejection. Abaye sees a connection between the two of them. The woman is independent of that, because in the end, she's the victim, and she's the one who has to stay married to him. So she'll have a right of refusal. But the connection between the right of refusal of the husband to be and the father are equated according to Abaye. If one has the right, the other one will also have the right. If one doesn't have the right, the other one will also not have the right. Now, Tosfot asks over here, which situation are we speaking about here that this woman has a right of refusal to get married? It says, Tei Malari, B'mai Mairi, Ibik Tana O Binara. If we're talking about a Tana or a Nara, Heicha Hi Yucholal Me'ein. How does the daughter have a right of refusal here? Because in another situation, Kevin Shav Rotzeh, if a father so chooses, he's allowed to marry off his daughter, even without her acquiescence. The Mishi Yirtzeh.
So why not over here? Do we not say the same thing? That why should the daughter have a right of refusal in this instance when the father, in any other circumstance, would have the right to marry her off without asking her? So the right of refusal should belong to the father and not to her. V'i b'she'en la'av, o shebagra, if the case is a case where she is a yitoma, or she's a bogeret, what do you need a pasuk for? She should be on her own now. And she should be able to refuse him because otherwise it's chote niskar. And she'd be able to refuse it. Forget about the father. She should have her own rights now to refuse the marriage because she could marry herself off anyway. She has the right of acceptance of marriage. So right, the Reis says something very interesting over here. He says, you're right. She cannot stop the marriage from going through. But what she can do over here is affect the knas. She can, by refusing to get married, force the mifateh to pay the knas, because she says, I don't want to get married. So her statement only has implications in the monetary realm, not in the side of kiddushin. Her father is the ultimate arbiter of who she gets married to. The same will be true in these cases. He'll be the arbiter of whether there is a rejection or not. So what is her impact? Why? What is her empowerment to say no? Empowerment to say no is whether he has to pay the knas at all. Which is a very interesting view of this, because I don't think that's how we would have seen this. We would have seen her right to reject this, right, reject the marriage at all. There are the Rishonim who say that it is litzdadim, which is when her father is empowered to marry her off, he's the one that can reject it. And when she is the one who is empowered to marry herself off, then she's the one who can reject it. And it's not that they have simultaneous rights of rejection. Whereas the Ran suggests that this is a unique circumstance where the girl does have a right of refusal, given the crime that was committed over here. The Gemara continues here. Tani idach, I have another brayta. Afal pi shamru ones noten miyad. Even though we say by ones he pays immediately. Kishiotzi hu ein la alav klum. If he divorces her, she has no claim against him. Mar says kishiotzi, when he divorces her, mi matzei bapik la. He can't divorce her. It says that he has to keep her as a wife for the remainder of his life. He has no right of divorce over here. Ema kishiotzi hi ein la alav klum. When she leaves, when she sues for divorce, she does not collect any monies from the ketubah. Basically, what this is saying is that she got a forward payment on her ketubah because of the manes, and therefore, later on, she doesn't collect on her ketubah because she already got that money up front. Mate, yatsa kesef knasa b'ketubata. Also, again, if he dies, if the husband dies, then she does not collect anything from her ketubah, because the kesef that was in her ketubah was already paid in the knas. That's the equation that we know. The monies of the ketubah are the same as the 50 shekel kesef in these cases, the moar abitubot. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, yesh la ketubah k'maneh. She has a ketubah of a bi'ulah. She doesn't have a ketubah of a bitulah. She still has a ketubah of a maneh. B'maika miflige. What is the machloket here? Rabbanan sarvar time in my takinu rabbanan ketubah. What's the reason that the rabbanan instituted a ketubah? So that she will not be easy to divorce. Here, he's not entitled to divorce her. Since he's not entitled to divorce her, why are we even discussing a ketubah? Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, Safar ha-nami mitzayr la, adam rahi lo b'inalach. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda says, you're right, he's not allowed to divorce her. But he can make her life so miserable that she will want to get divorced, and then he'll end up in a situation where she is suing for divorce. So because he can facilitate the divorce through her by making her life miserable, therefore it's equated to the fact that he could divorce her, and therefore we need the ketubah in place to prevent him from doing that or willy-nilly, saying that there are repercussions to divorce over here. That's why she needs a ketubah for protection. Now Tosafot over here, based on that, starts to discuss ketubah in general. He says all of this reasoning for ketubah should only apply in cases of divorce, not in cases of almanah. The whole point of a ketubah is to prevent him from willy-nilly sending her out. Then, why is the case of an almanah, why does she get a ketubah? An almanah is not a problem. Almanah is because he died. It wasn't that he sent her out. So Tosafot says, well, the reasoning by ketubah to almanah is a china, is because of chayin. And therefore, mitoch shehu tshuchu letakein bigrusha, shlo tegela meinav la'adziyo, tekinu nam almanah mishum china. Says that because we already make a takana by grusha, to protect the grusha, we have the ketubah. So at the same time, we took care of an almanah that she should also, because of chayin, have that protection. Now, Tosafot also says, "Afgal de betulah yesh la ketubah min haTorah." Even though Betulah has a Ketubah min HaTorah, which is not the Shita that Tosafot brought earlier in the Masechta, where he suggests that Ketubah is only Midrabanan, and that's why he questioned the Kesef, that is Shayich Laichi Midoraita, because it's not Midoraita, it's only Midrabanan. Over here, Tosafot states as a fact that the Ketubah of Betulah is min HaTorah, Zot Be'ulahi. Over here, that's not relevant because this woman is a Be'ulah. After the rape, she's already a Be'ulah, and therefore Ketubah is only Midrabanan. Implying that if it was a ketubah ve'betulah, it would have been a ketubah midoraita, which again is not a simple fact. We discussed this earlier in the Masechta, as to whether ketubah is really minatorah or midrabanan. Here Tosfot takes it for granted that it is midoraita, but not relevant over here because this woman is a be'ulah. Okay, we're going to stop over here by the two dots on the bottom of Lamed Tet Amud Bet.